Good morning and welcome to the Roundtable. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue. 10 minutes after 9 o'clock, time to begin this morning's panel discussion on topics in the news. Today we're joined by Associate Editor of the Times Union, Mike Spain.
Good morning, Ray.
Good morning. Wait for it. And Paul Conte, Assistant Professor of Communications at the College of St. Rose. Go.
Good morning, Ray.
Well, good morning.
Good morning,
Paul.
Mike.
Nice to have
morning,
you both here.
Paul.
So, casinos, a week from yesterday, the vote in New York, Prop 1. Finally, we are starting to hear and see the ads. Now, it's we talked about this for the last several months off and on, and I spoke to Jimmy Vielkind about it, your former associate, Mike, and we were both shocked a month or two ago that there were not ads. Yeah, but now here they come.
Right. Well, you know, there was some speculation that that was the strategy, that there wouldn't be a lot said about it. It would be low key. And then right at the end, you'd get hammered with the ads. And I guess that's kind of what's happening, whether that was the plan originally or it took them a while to pull the money together. But there's big money behind it. James Odato, who follows this very closely for us, had a story Monday, that reported that some of the big companies that are own casinos, like Genting, which operates the facility in Queens, the Racino that has the slots, the video slots, is a big backer, and the companies that operate Racinos upstate are also backing it. People who want it to happen are pooling their resources and going after it, and I think that they have a big advantage monetarily over those who are opposing it.
Does that mean the fact that these Racinos and Genting, who has a history already somewhat murky, not murky, but there were some questions back in the day, is their support of this indicative of the fact that the fix is in and there will be full casinos in these locations?
Well, I think everybody at the State Wagering and Racing Board, which will oversee, you know, the assigning of casinos, would say no, of course not, and it'll be a competitive bidding process. But they already have facilities; they're already in the business. They would merely need to expand it. That's the speculation of what's going to happen in the Hudson Valley. That Saratoga Springs certainly has an edge because of the Racino there, and they already are planning a big expansion that would certainly complement having Las Vegas style gambling there. So obviously they're going to want to put these casinos, if the amendment does pass, they would want to put them where they're going to have the greatest opportunity to succeed. And where would that be? A place where there were already is a demonstrated audience.
Yeah, it's yes.
Oh, that's it. What do you say for me, Paul? Paul Conte, ladies and gentlemen.
Well, and I think that it'll be interesting to see how this breaks down. The Siena Research Institute released a public opinion poll that they did over the past week that primarily focused on downstate voters in the city, and the margin of support
was interesting.
It's pretty significant. They don't want them there. But there's a NIMBY element to it, but they're in favor of the measure, and it's a significant size sample. A lot of these surveys that we see this time of year are based on a 400 person sample, and this is a 700 person sample, and that reduces the margin of error. So that's a pretty good number, and it's not close. It's not close at all. So margin of error either way, it's still overwhelmingly in favor.
And in theory, the voting will be fairly strong because of what is happening in New York City on Tuesday.
Right.
This may bode well for that for Prop 1.
Right, because the numbers are down in New York City. If they're already at the poll, they'll be able to vote on it. That's one of the worries of people who have different positions on the various constitutional amendments that go before the voters next week, that there's going to be a low turnout, and people are not educated about them, and that even the ones that turn out may not vote on all of them, and that could skew it. But how it will skew it is really hard to guess, except that New York City seems to be in favor of upstate casinos, and they're going to be going to the polls anyway.
As Paul alluded, the NIMBY factor is interesting here, and it seems to pop up in Massachusetts when there are casino votes. you know, not in my backyard. Yeah, I'm all for this, but I don't want to be near it.
I'd like them near my backyard.
Yes.
So that if I want to go to one, I can go to your backyard and do my gambling. Like the Catskills.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So that's a win-win because, at least in the first phase, that's what Governor Cuomo wants, upstate casinos, not downstate casinos.
But after 7 years, they can begin the process of having a casino in New York City. And that's what some of the opponents of the casino amendment are saying, that this is really a stealth effort to get casinos in Manhattan. That's where the big chains really want to compete for an opportunity to have gambling, like maybe a big casino in Times Square. Now, I don't know whether that's the strategy or not, but that's where the population is. And the operation in Queens, operated by Genting, is, they say, like the largest racino or, you know, video lottery operation, you know, in the country. I mean, it's just an enormous success. So it is bringing in lots of money. And I think when you couch it that way, a lot of people are passive about it. And I may not like casino gambling, but if someone wants to throw their money away at it and it's going to lower my taxes and improve education, that's the way it was portrayed, which, of course, is the rub that so many people are criticizing.
Right. But when you look at the success of the Turning Stone operation, which is not a state-owned or state-run casino, I mean, that went from a metal Quonset hut-like bingo parlor to a resort area with championship golf courses. It's highly
lovely.
Successful.
The question is, and I've never been able to get a solid answer, is how much economic benefit there has been in that region, a fairly, not depressed, but a region that
certainly
could use a shot in the arm. How much they've benefited outside of the casino itself?
Well, my sense is that there is significant benefit because there was a squabble initially when they started to expand it over whether or not the tribal lands that they claimed were tribal lands were actually tribal lands or whether they reacquired land that they had previously owned centuries ago and then declared it tribal lands again. But in the push-pull on that, some of the people who opposed the construction initially, after 5 or 6 or 10 years of operation, are solidly behind it. And when you look at the support mechanisms that are required to make that thing run, just the linen franchise.
Yeah. Right. Well, it has been successful in expanding the draw, not just gambling. I mean, they have entertainment now.
Oh, absolutely.
And a lot of people go for the entertainment, and they bring in some big shows. And then the golf courses, which I think you mentioned, I've heard it said that they are some of the best golf courses in upstate New York, north of New York City. So, that's a draw. So it's not just people coming there to gamble and then go home, which is what a lot of people are worried about with this gambling proposition, that it will take the entertainment money out of other venues in the region. And that's why some of the arts groups are cautiously hoping to partner with this operation, if it is to happen somewhere in the region, to broaden the draw so it isn't all just going to the slot machines and the tables and et cetera.
Talking to Mike Spain of the Albany Times Union and Paul Conte, Assistant Professor of Communications at the College of St. Rose. Prop 1 goes before New York voters on Tuesday. And if you guys had to make a guess, now we've seen the ads. Yes, we're all in for jobs, and they're starting to hit us on the radio and on the TV, and now the blitz has come. If you guys had to put money on it, which was fairly appropriate.
Interesting.
Nice metaphor.
Does it pass? Does it not pass?
I think it passes.
Yeah, I agree with you. I think I don't know if it's momentum. I think it's almost the other way around. I think a lot of people just accept the fact you've got Turning Stone. You can go to Foxwoods in Connecticut. It looks like you're going to be able to go to somewhere in the Springfield area to do it, to do casino gambling. And, you know, there's some in Western New York, in Niagara Falls. So people just feel like it's already there. There might as well be some, people aren't opposed to it.
Right, but how much is too much?
And, oh, yeah.
And is it anybody's business to say it's too much? I mean, should we let the marketplace regulate that? I guess that's the question.
Yeah, as long as there's not state money being invested in the construction of them.
Yeah, there are certainly a lot of reasons why, a lot of valid reasons why people are opposed to They say that it's if it's existing already, that is not a reason to expand it. They see that it's going to studies show that it actually hits people in the middle class, and even people who are below the middle class line spend a lot of time and a lot of money. It actually, women spend a lot of time. Women who can't afford it spend a lot of time in front of slot machines. This is what the opponents say that studies show, and it's basically a transfer of money, you know, from people who really can't afford it to keep taxes lower for people who probably could afford it. I mean, this is a compelling case.
Well, we shall see. Go ahead, Paul.
I was just going to say that without a lot of very interesting issues in upstate to bring voters to the polls,
right.
the Siena poll suggests that this thing is going to pass by a pretty big margin. I mean, as one of the people that keeps track of what people in this region are going to be voting on, there are a significant number of communities that don't have races with opposition, meaning that only one party
right.
nominated a candidate, or in a remarkably large number of instances, no candidates.
Yeah, that's right.
They're open. But there's no reason to draw voters, and I'm not sure that the six issues at the top are going to get people there.
Well, we will see, and of course, we'll have full coverage here at WAMC. 9:22 is the time. It's the roundtable. Mike Spain is here. Paul Conte. I'm Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue this morning. We'll take a break. We'll be right back. Welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. Ray Graff in for Joe Donahue, Mike Spain of the Times Union, Paul Conte of the College of St. Rose here with us this morning. And, Mike, we turn to the fine pages of your paper today. Turmoil in ethics hiring. James Odato, following some rare public discord, the members of the Joint Commission on Public Ethics on Tuesday announced the hiring of a lawyer close to Governor Cuomo as the Integrity Operations' new executive director. The appointment of Letizia Tagliafiero, decided behind closed doors during a commissioner's meeting, ends a search begun in May. Tagliafiero, who previously served as Jacobs' investigation director, fills the job vacated this summer by Jacobs' first executive director, Ellen Bibin. So, Mike, fill us in.
Well, James Odato is following Jacob very closely, and he's reporting today that there's some turmoil, or at least some disagreement, among members of the Joint Commission on Public Ethics, or JCOPE as it's commonly called, about selecting Letizia Tagliafiero because she has such close ties to Governor Cuomo. She worked with him when he was Attorney General, and she people see that as a connection to the second floor, and there was a nationwide search to fill Ellen Bibin's position as executive director. And this is what they came up with, somebody who was already on the staff of JCOPE. Now, that's a strength, according to some members who are quoted in today's story. You know, they say that she's performed exemplary in her work as a counsel to the JCOPE, and that it's no problem, and they think that she's best suited to become the executive director. But there is a report that the Associated Press had late Tuesday that Ellen Yaroshevsky, who is a member of the commission, has decided to leave, and it's insinuated that it was, although there's no comment, public comment here, it's insinuated that she left because she disagreed with the appointment of the new executive director with such close ties to Governor Cuomo.
Is this a situation where you're damned if you do, if you're damned if you don't? Tagliafiero, she worked for Senate Republicans. She also has close ties with Democrats. Mm-hmm. It would seem that this would be sort of a happy medium. If I'm the governor, I put somebody like that in the top spot.
You would hope that somebody wouldn't be penalized if they're competent and capable, and they've demonstrated through their performance that they can work with both sides of the aisle, just because they have a connection to the governor. But I think it brings up something that came up in the other commission to fight corruption in Albany that was appointed by the governor, the Moreland Act Commission, where some members have complained privately, and it's gotten out that the governor's office have tried to have influence over some of the decisions by the Moreland Act Commission. And recently they kind of asserted their independence and have decided to seek subpoena power to go after lawmakers to have them reveal their outside incomes, and especially if they're attorneys and they're representing entities that may go before the legislature. So, you know, there's this back and forth. If you want these commissions like Jay Cope and the Moreland Act Commission to be able to do what they're supposed to do, and that is fight government corruption and promote ethics, they need independence.
Paul, as a TV guy, long news cred, does the public just tune out eventually? I mean, this is interests you and me and Mike and people in newsrooms, but does the public really care at this point about the details?
I would imagine they're pretty skeptical.
Yeah,
I would think that public, public officials and corruption in government circles is of great concern to the electorate. But when you get stories like this about the internal squabbling and the back and forth, I would imagine it creates distrust.
How do you program that on your TV show? Where do you put that?
You mean in terms of
TV
newscast?
Yeah. Behind sports?
It's a tough soundbite, isn't
it? It is. You can't get a soundbite because nobody's going to go on the record. I mean, if the AP can't get a quotable source on somebody's resignation, what chance is a television camera going to have? I would suspect that were this to be pitched at the morning meeting, it would get reduced to a 12, 15-second copy story that would go in the B block towards the end of it before you head into weather.
But inside the Beltway, so to speak,
yeah,
in Albany, it is getting a lot of buzz and a lot of attention. And you know, the New York Times and the New York papers and, of course, the we in Albany at the Times Union are following it very closely because our audience is somewhat of a heightened interest because this is where the ethical violations allegedly have happened and the corruption needs to be weeded out. So while it might not play to the wider audience, it is having influence, and it is the kind of it'll give politicians the kind of ammunition they need to pass reforms or for candidates who are challenging incumbents to go after them.
If they come up with anything.
Yeah,
we need some red meat.
As a
viewer at home waiting for the B block to end so I can hear the weather, I don't care until they come up with something.
That's an excellent point. I don't think people are watching it closely like they're watching like a sporting event or the World Series or...
Wait, he said we weren't going to do that till the end of the show.
Okay. but I don't mean to...
Forward promotion, you know.
Right. But they will look at the results. If they come out with a study that says, you know, so-and-so, you know, violated public trust and or may have committed a crime by doing such and such, that will become the red meat that you spoke of.
Okay, and that's a good spot to end our first half hour. Mike Spain of the Times Union is here. Paul Conte of the College
I'll be
of
leaving.
You're leaving.
I got to leave.
You've had enough. Well, we'll we'll find a fill-in. It's probably Gustino. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC. Welcome back to The Roundtable on WAMC. 9:36 is the time, and we welcome Mike Spain of the Times Union to our discussion this morning. And, surprise, look what the cat dragged in.
Oh,
Dave Gustino
literally.
Is here. Hi,
hey,
Dave.
How you doing?
Filling in for Paul Conte.
I'm here.
Who's filling in for Rosemary Armeo.
Kind of like you remember Superfly back in the World Wrestling days and Roddy Piper? I'm on tag team. I got tagged. I'm in.
All right. So fair enough. I hope you brought something to the table. So back
you don't
to,
look happy.
Back to the news. This is from the New York Times, Michael S. Schmidt. And it's a story we've been covering here. The NSA head says European data was collected by allies. The head of the National Security Agency on Tuesday vigorously challenged recent reports that the U.S. had been gathering the phone records of millions of Europeans, saying that the records had in fact been turned over by Allied spy services. This is not information we collected on European citizens, said the agency's director, General Keith B. Alexander. And James Clapper, the director of National Intelligence, broadly defended the NSA's practice of spying on foreign leaders. Such espionage, they said, was a basic pillar of American intelligence operations that had gone on for decades. Discuss. Mike Spain, you're first.
Well, I think James Clapper, the director's comments that it's one of the first things I learned in intelligence school in 1963, and that is that countries, including allies, spy on the United States, and we spy back. I mean, it's been this way for decades. It dates back into the Cold War, and probably previous to all that, there were you know, even before electronics, there was spying going on. And it's just a way for countries to understand how other countries are going to deal with them, to help them prepare for that, to see how it plays in Peoria. You know, what's said.
Or Pyongyang.
Or Pyongyang. And you know, this is a fact of life in that it's coming out now. Everyone is acting surprise, surprise, and it's not that big a surprise. And in fact, it's important to NATO. And these are, you know, this is information that's being gathered by them and given to us. So it isn't all as, you know, it would be reported, I guess.
And we were sort of waiting for this next shoe to drop, which is in the New York Post this morning, Ray. We see using the cartoon Spies Like Us with a story.
Spy versus spy.
Spy versus spy. Yeah, I'm doing the song from the movie. Russian spies military presents. This is You Shouldn't Have, Vlad. This is in the New York Post, and it says, crafty Russian operatives gave goodie bags to world powers at the G20 summit with USB drives and phone chargers, but they were, quote, Trojan horses designed to download info and send it back to the motherland. Does that give any credence to the NSA chief saying they're doing it too?
Well, I mean, okay, if they're, first of all, never take a USB drive from a Russian bearing gifts. I mean, but
he might have had a shirtless.
Now, in fairness, a spokesman for Vladimir Putin denied that these were loaded with, spy equipment, and that they were just gifts.
They did have shirtless JPEGs, though.
All right, that's fine. But getting back to Mike's point, and I'll throw this out for you guys to discuss: is it okay, just because everybody does it, is it okay that it's done?
No.
By whose measure? Or I mean, whose world is this?
Well, by the Lord's world, is it all right?
Well, the fact that it is done creates that situation where if you're being spied on and you're not spying, you have a disadvantage.
Yeah.
And everybody is trying to keep an advantage over everybody else. So in a competitive world, I don't think that ethics come into this or morality comes into it. It just becomes a fact of life. It's part of the intelligence gathering. The chancellor may get up and say something very neutral about a U.S. program or a U.S. plan to invade such and such a place. But by the spying that we're doing or the eavesdropping that we're doing, we'll know they're actually quite supportive of us, but they're just hedging their bets because, you know, of political situations in Germany. Now, they could also probably read that in the German newspapers, but, you know, it's just another bit of information that gets used to help the United States understand what their allies are really thinking.
Well, I think in short, no. In a perfect world, you wouldn't spy on your allies. And, you know, to that end, Obama is talking about a ban on spying on our allies. But I think it comes down to the issue of, unfortunately, everybody does it, just don't get caught. And when you do get caught, there's a lot that comes out and a lot of shouting and yelling. But what's going to change, really?
If we take what Mike said as written, and I believe him, actually, that, you know, everybody does this. Everybody knows that everybody does this. So is the Snowden, the pile of revelations that Snowden laid on everybody, just this a tremendous PR opportunity for everyone to get a good slap in on the U.S.?
It seems like that's what ends up happening in the end. And a lot of people slapping the United States around. Now we see this story out of Russia. But again, things go on. And then when somebody gets caught, that's when the bomb explodes.
Yeah, I think there's a a piling on that happens when this kind of thing comes out. It's easy when you have a lot of turmoil in domestically to have something like this come up and to be outraged at it and to make a big deal out of it in the European countries. It takes attention away from home, you know, domestic problems, and there are a lot of economic problems in the EU. So it's probably useful in that regard. But maybe I'm really skeptical, but don't you think behind the scenes they're saying, yeah, we all knew this was happening, but let's just get what mileage we can out of it, and then we'll go on.
Operationally, long-term damage, you think?
Well, I mean, you know, here's Mike Spain from Albany, New York, trying to make a long-term view. I mean, these things blow over, but it will, it can help the U.S. standing, and it will probably diminish the ability of the U.S. to have a better negotiation on some unrelated you know, trade pact, or maybe in trying to build a coalition on, you know, fighting global warming, or whatever is on the agenda. It's just kind of there, and it gives them a chit when they're negotiating with the U.S. over something that's contentious.
Is this story a chit this morning in the New York Post? In other words, you know, will journalists be looking for other countries to have been doing the same thing, looking to see if they've been spying on the U.S. and other countries? And, you know, is the Obama administration even involved in trying to get some of this information leaked out?
I mean, it seems almost sophomoric that they would gimmick up some gifts that they give to visiting diplomats.
Yeah.
That would
it has
it
a nice
does.
50s vibe you know, to it. It
almost seems like an Austin Powers movie.
And what is the you know, the Chancellor of Germany going to do? Take this nice USB drive that the Russians gave her and plug it into her laptop and have it send across the internet all the secrets of the German. I mean, it seems like spy versus spy in the old Mad magazine, you know.
Yeah. Well, hence the New York Post cover.
Yes.
The Roundtable on WAMC. Times Union Associate Editor Mike Spain is here. David Gustina, our own morning news anchor. And we'll switch to another one from your paper, Mike. Kind of a more upbeat story today. This is from Eric Anderson. Grads can engineer bright future in the region.
Well, you might call this the Malta effect, the chip fab effect. Maybe it's the University of Caliaros effect, you know, the College for Nanoscale Science and Technology here in Albany. But for whatever reason, a very scholarly group called Nerd Scholar has established that the capital region has the 10th best metropolitan area for engineers to find a job. And they use data from some reputable organizations, not that they're not one themselves, like the Brookings Institute, which ranked metro areas by their share of overall job openings made up of openings for engineers. And, of course, on top of that list was Silicon Valley and, interestingly, Detroit, because there's so much research and development being done for the auto industry in Detroit. And then Houston, you know, you got the Johnson Space Center and et cetera. And then you have the petrochemical industry. So there's a lot of demand in these markets. But in the capital region, there's also a lot of demand. Of course, we have Global Foundries, the chip manufacturing plant in Saratoga County. And you do have the Albany Nanotech operation, you know, the Semitech International Consortium of Chip Manufacturers is now located and based at Albany Nanotech, and IBM has a big investment here. And then there's the traditional places where, you know, General Electric has its research and development center here, and that certainly attracts lots of engineers from around the world. And then you have other big companies like Albany Molecular, you know, Research. And you know, so it is a good place. And engineers are good for the community. Their median salary is about double what the median salary
is. $75,000.
Yeah. And they bring a lot to the community. And these have, you know, ancillary benefits. You know, usually people, when they come into a community, will get involved in cultural and educational efforts, and they just enhance the community. So we're used to that because of General Electric historically, and because of RPI and Union College used to churn out engineers. They don't do that so much anymore, but RPI certainly does. So we're lucky to have that.
Is it possible there's a ripple effect here, too? I mean, I spoke with Judy Patrick this morning, our friend from the Schenectady Gazette, and they had a story on Schenectady County going for one of these land grants.
Right.
And they took a regional approach on it, and they didn't get it. We were left out of these grants. And I wonder, you know, because when the housing crisis happened, Albany was in a much better – this region was in a much better position, believe it or not. And I wonder how much the Tech Valley and – people with a salary and purchasing homes and
home prices have not really gone up.
No, I know. And I'm just wondering if that ripple effect means less foreclosed properties here, less need for land grants and things like that.
I saw that story in the Daily Gazette, and we had a similar story by Jordan Carlio Evangelist in the Times Union. And the point I think that it made was we're not eligible for these funds.
That's right.
Because we are doing better than Buffalo, Rochester, Syracuse, and I mean, even Suffolk County got
one of the
grants, which I was surprised to hear. I would have thought Suffolk County on the outer part of Long Island was, you know, shielded from some of the negative effects because they have the Hamptons out there.
And I'm not saying for a second nanotech is the reason, but it makes you think about whether that helps keep everybody up.
It certainly can't hurt. You know, in his story today, Eric Anderson, where he's talking about this, he quotes, you know, James Ross from the State Department of Labor,
who basically says that even though there are a lot of engineers, it still makes up only 1% of
right.
the 600,000 jobs in the region. So it's the spin-offs.
And we have education. Mm-hmm. We have the university and all the colleges that are around here that I think probably helps keep incomes up and a constant supply and employment.
And state government is not as big as it was, but it certainly is big. And the healthcare industry
right.
is enormous.
Huge.
Around here. Yeah.
So all right,
we're lucky.
I have to ask our engineer, Hopper, did I take a break yet? No, I did not take a break. And by the way, our producer, Sarah LeDuc, probably upset with me as I have not mentioned the email address once. You can join the conversation by email. I'm a fill-in. What do you
want?
You
can join. Do we really want
to? Well, you can. Well, also, hello to the gentleman who emailed saying I was a shock jock. A big Baba Booey to you, my friend. You can join the conversation by emailing us at roundtable@wamc.org. You can also comment on our webpage or Facebook page or tweet us at WAMC Roundtable. And you are listening to the Roundtable. Baba Booey. We'll be back.
Support for WAMC comes from Spot Coffee, Saratoga Springs, New York, a community-oriented cafe featuring fresh roasted coffee, baked goods, soup, salads, pizza, and more. SpotCoffee.com. The Honest Weight Food Co-op, open at their new location, 100 Watervliet Avenue, Albany. Offering local and organic produce, groceries, and more. HonestWeight.coop. And Springbrook Oneonta, New York, supporting people of all ages with developmental disabilities, working in schools, in homes, and in communities across New York to help individuals achieve independence. SpringbrookNY.org.
And welcome back to the Roundtable on WAMC. 10 minutes before 10 o'clock, Mike Spain of the Albany Times Union is with us. Our own Dave Gustina is sitting in for Paul Conti, who is sitting in for Rosemary Armeo. And I'm Ray Graff, sitting in for Joe Donahue. So it's the irregulars, except for Mike, who's very regular. And nice,
huh?
Well, nice to have you all here. Well,
hey now.
So anyway, there was a thing, and I apologize. I tried to print this before we started the show, and the printer printed blank pages, which was nice.
Ooh, we must be in for a great day then.
The New York City Council voting on a proposal to raise the cigarette age, the buying age in New York,
age, right.
to 21.
Hmm. Well, a lot of this has to do with the so-called e-cigarettes. That's the electronic cigarettes, which are actually the New York Times did an extraordinary piece on Sunday about the proliferation of this phenomenon, where they call them kind of a smokeless cigarette, and they cut one open. And, you know, took a photo of it. It's got like a chip in there. It's
yeah,
got an
yeah.
LED light that yeah. kind of mimics a, you know, the
lighting
burning,
up.
Right, lighting up. And they're trying to get it so that it kind of bursts in the back of your throat and burns you a little bit to give you, you know, the sense of a real cigarette. But it's not quite as hot as a real cigarette.
No,
but they're working on it.
Marketplace has also been covering yeah. the issue of e-cigarettes.
Well, one of the problems is that some of them now are flavored. You know, they flavor
right.
watermelon and chocolate, and they're aiming them at the teen market. So you have to be 18 in New York to buy cigarettes. They're talking about raising it to 21. But it's even now, you know, kind of making its way to a younger audience. I don't know if maybe raising the age is a symbolic effort or if that'll make it a little more difficult for kids who are 16 and 17 to get their hands on these. But the tobacco industry is seeing this as a way to kind of bring, you know, cigarette smoking back inside because it's not as offensive, and they're looking, you know, to basically take people out of the rainy doorways and cold doorways where they are relegated to have their smokes.
Yeah. It's nicotine vapor, right, Mike?
It is. It's a nicotine vapor, and it satisfies the, you know, the craving that people who smoke cigarettes have for nicotine. It's it doesn't have all of the other you know, problems that smoking tobacco has, right? But and some people use it as a bridge. They'll use it, and then they'll smoke regular cigarettes offline.
Well, you know, it's a real double-edged sword, because I can see how it'll satisfy your nicotine cravings. They are in fact less harmful than regular cigarettes. I do think the real problem is the kids.
Uh-huh.
In other words, it's so accessible and perceived as so innocuous that it may have a a bad effect. And maybe that is what the evil doers would want.
Not to mention, if you've been paying attention, there have been a huge number of celebrity endorsements for these products.
Bruno Mars is one of the ones who is throwing his his audience. He's a popular musician who's very popular among young people, and it kind of gets back to what we were used to when
candy cigarettes.
Right. I mean, it takes away some of the stigma of it. I mean, it used to be that it was common, cigarette smoking indoors was common.
Sure.
And then the news came out about both the dangers and the way that the cigarette companies hid the dangers, and that caused a big backlash, and now there's anti-smoking laws all over the place. The price of cigarettes has gone up, and they're really looking at this as a way to come back in on the and grow their market. And it's all about, as the New York Times story pointed out on Sunday in their business section, it's all about making money.
Mm-hmm. Right you are. All right, we have about 4 minutes left here, gentlemen, and I think we would be wise to discuss David's favorite team in the whole wide world, and that's the Boston Red Sox. They're on the verge.
Do you have your notes ready, David?
I do. Of another World Series. They have
to win. I did
not
ask for this.
Tonight.
Yes.
In Boston, and it'll be, you mentioned to me the other day, and I didn't realize this, the first time they would have won a World Series at home.
At home is correct.
Since 1918.
And you'll know what happened after that year, after Babe Ruth went away to the New York Yankees, of course. That's what they're referring to, 1918, the last time the Red Sox won a World Series with Babe Ruth on the team at home. Now, of course, tonight, Game 6, we have Waka versus Lackey.
Waka is a phenom.
Unbelievable.
Pitcher for the St. Louis Cardinals. However, this is the biggest possible stage a young kid could be thrust into. We'll see what he's made of today.
Here's something interesting. They asked John Lackey at a press conference yesterday, who had to pitch in the same situation for the Angels as a rookie. And they said, can you have any sense of what Waka will be going through tomorrow night? He said, all we do is throw pitches. All we do is try to make those pitches. And all we want is not to upset our other teammates. So he says, all I could think was I got to get through and turn it over to the bullpen. And, I think we have to, after seeing this series, recognize that the Cardinals aren't going to lay down. I mean,
no.
This is going to be a tough, tough game tonight. And while I'd love to see the Red Sox win, I think Waka could end up being the MVP of the series if he can pull off a win tonight for the Cardinals.
But only if the Cardinals then win again tomorrow.
That's correct. But as you know, Ray, you get to a seventh game, all bets are off.
Really? Go ahead, Mike.
Now, I just wondered, David, you're here awfully, awfully early in the morning.
Yeah.
Do you stay up and watch the ends of the game?
Thanks,
or
Mike.
The beginning of the game.
For that matter.
Unfortunately, in addition to being one of the largest Red Sox fans around, I also have caught up in the superstition of baseball. So I have this thing where now the one game I was able to watch on Saturday, they lost. And they lost in one of the most weird ways possible. So, as you know, Ray's going to get upset. But
yeah, because you're miserable. Win or lose,
yes,
you're miserable.
Yes, I am. But I was raised on 86 years of heartache, and I've let a lot of that go, as you will testify to.
I will not testify to that.
Darn it! Well, what about Poppy?
That's a great point, and we'll fill 1 minute of our valuable time talking about Big Poppy, who may now be the greatest World Series hitter of all time.
Well, I mean, a 733 average?
At 70 years old. It's shocking.
And yet, still, these young pitchers on the Cardinals talk about how they don't want to walk him, that they want to pitch to him. And I think, somewhat logic would dictate at this point you might want to work around him. But I still think you'll see Waka try to pitch to him in the first. I mean, he'll pitch outside. He'll try to make his spots, but I can't, obviously there's been a lot of stuff on the internet and people talking about Ortiz and having shown up on a steroid report at one point and a lot of things being said about that. I hear that coming through the ether. But I have to say, as a proof to his longevity, boy, in the postseason, you've never really seen anything like it.
Mike, you a Red Sox fan?
I like the Red Sox. I'm not the diehard fan that David is, but I have a lot of respect for Red Sox fans. Some of my friends and family
some
members.
Some of my best friends are Red Sox fans.
Well, my grandfather and my grandmother lived and died, and they never saw him win a world championship.
I feel badly, David, that the curse that you have is that you can't watch them where it's a curse on them. It's just the irony of that is too difficult.
Well, you could DVR the game, and then hopefully no one will tell you what happens.
Right. Just stay away from the media.
Right. Oh,
I'm sure you've
don't
seen
read
that.
The papers or watch.
I'm sure you've seen that Seinfeld episode. Forget it; it never works.
No, it never does work. All right, so in the final 20 seconds, prediction tonight and series, David Gustina.
Tonight, I believe the Bats are going to come out in big form. I think they're home. They're confident. Victorino back in the lineup. Napoli back in the lineup. They can smell it. And I think they're going to give Waka a hard time. I'd like to believe that. If not, whoa.
Okay. Mike?
I think there'll be a seventh game. It just seems like that's what's going to happen.
I agree. There will be a seventh game, and the Cardinals will prevail. You're listening to The Roundtable on WAMC, and more on the way.